The Flemish Velonews podcast continues here from Waregem. I'm Fred Dreyer. I am joined by Andy Hood. Andy, we describe the setting for us. We're no longer in a junior high school gym. This actually is a pretty nice media room setup.
We have definitely upgraded in the world. We are outside outside the VIP zone, inside a posh press room in the local football club stadium, and talking to one of the girls over there, telling me how getting more money, stadium's growing, bigger and bigger. Great place to work today, Fred.
Yeah, no, Hugo actually told us that this stadium has been in construction over the last 5 years, and Waregem, they like, when they have some money, they add a little bit more to it, and they run out of money and get some more money, add a little bit more to it. So I think they must have just recently added this media room because it's pretty posh. They got a full bar in here, which is dangerous for
us. No beer for the journalists.
I know.
They knew better than that.
Well, we have some great discussion today in the podcast because we just finished watching Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen, which is the midweek Wednesday race in between Gent-Wevelgem and the Tour of Flanders. Really cool race. It starts off in Roeselare, which is a very historic cycling town. There's a really great bike museum there. Goes out into, you know, the famed hills of Flanders, climbs some of the climbs that we're going to see at the Tour of Flanders, climbs them from different directions. Not quite as long as a big monument, but it's a, you know, a stiff 5 hours of racing, and then it finishes here in Waregem. And we saw a thrilling finish with Matthew Vanderpoel, 24-year-old cyclocrosser, taking his first World Tour victory. It wasn't a shocking win because he rode into this breakaway and was the fastest finisher in it. But in other regards, it's a shocking win because this was, you know, his second World Tour race, Hoodie. You ever seen anything like this before?
Not during my lifetime. I wasn't around in the Eddie Merckx days. But I mean, come on, what a great debut. I mean, he was fourth, just missed the podium Sunday at Gent-Wevelgem. And then to really step up today and just really smack it out of the park. I mean, just an impressive ride. Just kind of the way he can ride and the way he can read the race. He read it so smart. I mean, there was that race stoppage, which we'll talk about in a little while. Just for him to kind of really just took the race by the scruff of the neck and really took control of the race and attacked. Didn't want to wait for a bunch sprint. And really wanted to get ahead of the race a little bit going into some of those bergs and rode smart. And then you had Bob Jungels out there, who's obviously been very strong as well, pretty strong group, and just finished it off with a flourish. I mean, those genes that he has are really paying off.
Yeah, it was definitely a both bronze and brains win where he was aggressive and smart enough to make it into this day's breakaway. Smart enough to ride in it conservatively, and he knew he was the fastest finisher in this group, so he was putting efforts in to continue to drive it to the line because, hey, the group behind was chasing, group behind wanted to bring it back, but with Matthew Vanderpoel, Bob Jungels, and Lukas Postelberger, Anthony Turgis in there, you know, Thijs Benoot, you had a lot of talent in there working to drive this break on. All Vanderpoel really had to do was not screw up the sprint, and he showed, you know, he, like you said, he's this physical specimen. He can put in these efforts, he can climb, he can ride flats, and then he has this fast sprint at the end. So, Hoodie, I mean, is this like the beginning of the Matthew Vanderpoel era? Like, what do you think today signifies for pro cycling?
Well, it's certainly the dawning of a new age, but I think we'll have to put a stop on that at least until after the 2020 Olympics, because Vanderpoel was racing, eyeing, trying to get a gold medal in mountain biking. Of course, there's no cyclocross Olympic medal, and maybe the road scene, he's just not, doesn't really, he thinks that it's quite a hilly, challenging course in Tokyo, so he thinks his best chance to get Olympic medals in the mountain biking. So, you know, what strikes me about Vanderpoel is that this is like his hobby job, right? He's a cyclocross world champion. He's targeting now mountain biking. And just looking at his pal Marty, he's already won 14 road races. Today was his first World Tour race and his second start. I mean, the guy is just, you know, he's got the pedigree, of course. He's the grandson of Poulidor. His father won the Tour of Flanders. So, you know, he's obviously got the good genes. But I was just impressed today. I was impressed with the kid on Sunday, just being in that group of that really hard edition of Gent-Wevelgem. And that was a hard man's race, going the distance, 250Ks plus. And then today, just really, I mean, there was a few of the heavy hitters weren't here. A lot of the big favorites for Flanders decided to skip the race today. But take nothing away. I mean, this is a World Tour race. They were racing balls out and impressive all the way around.
So this is an interesting race. We've seen some rejiggering of the classic schedule in recent years. And 2 years ago, Flanders Classics, which owns the, you know, the Tour of Flanders, Gent Wevelgem, all the big races, moved this race, Dwarsdorf-Landeren, into this midweek spot in between Gent Wevelgem and Tour of Flanders. And the whole concept with Dwarsdorf-Landeren is it's the Doors of Flanders. It's this race that sort of ties together these two sections of Flanders, and it has cobblestones, but it's not quite as hard as the Tour of Flanders. And it solidified this block of racing, and now this block of racing is for both the men's peloton and the women's peloton to draw just a ton of attention. And the race is interesting. It kicks off in the center of Roeselare, and it's a weekday. You know, you'd think people are going to work, but I describe the scene in the middle, in this, in that center square in Roeselare, hoodie. We saw a lot of people who were playing hooky from work.
There was definitely a lot of people playing hooky. I think a lot of people also on playing hooky with their bosses, you know, leading the way. We saw these caravans of vans coming in this morning. Looked like some sort of accounting company had rented out 4 or 5 vans. They're all full of the dorks who are there 9 to 5, you know, hey, let's go watch the race. And we just saw just parades of people moving into the town square. And man, the biggest cheers came for Alejandro Valverde, who showed up in the rainbow jersey today. He raced this race last year kind of as a precursor going into the Tour de France, which had the cobbles last year. This year he's back, man. He's going to race on Sunday. So really the big buzz was around Valverde. Everyone was kind of crowding in, trying to get a picture of the rainbow jersey, trying to get a word in with him. And he wasn't really too keen on talking to the media. But I did talk to his sport director, Chente Garcia Costa, who told me that it was kind of almost his idea to put the seed in Valverde's brain last year after he won the Worlds. And he said, mate, you know, you've won a lot of these big races in your career, but you cannot finish your career without racing Flanders. So great scene this morning. I was surprised how many folks were out because it was supposed to rain. You'd be kind of, you know, but it was a pretty nice day here in Flanders.
It was clear, but I got to say, it was cold. You walked around the pits and riders had, you know, full tights on, coats.
Even Stijn Vandenberg had tights on. I couldn't believe
it. Yeah, even Stijn Vandenberg was cold. So it was definitely a cold day. You saw, you know, it was cold enough to see your breath. They were wearing coats. They were wearing headbands, stuff like that. But yet it didn't dull the ambiance. I mean, the beer was definitely flowing at 10 a.m. on a Wednesday in Roeselare, and people were out in full force. So the race kicked off about noon and headed out into the countryside. We didn't get a ton of coverage around the race, so we didn't really see what was going on. When we did tune in, we noticed that there was a breakaway up the road. And, you know, the action, you know, by that point it had warmed up too. And you know what? I was really impressed to see the crowds along the side of the road were pretty good. It seemed like rural Flanders on this, you know, Wednesday in the middle of spring found a way to come out.
Yeah, I mean, that just shows how much these people love these races, how much cycling really is part of this, the pedigree of Flanders. Everyone kind of makes the jokes, bikes, beers, and bergs, but it's really true. And, I mean, I'm looking forward to having some nice beer every night after covering these races. But it always just, you know, it's always just so nice to be, if you're part of the cycling family, just to come here. This is like one of the holy grounds.
So, Hoodie, you mentioned this is a race that a number of the big hitters took off. So there was no Greg Van Avermaet. Quickstep seemed like they were here with sort of a B squad. You had Yves Lampaert, but who was the defending champion.
Gilbert was kind of sick.
Gilbert wasn't doing so good. No Stibar. Wout van Aert stayed at home. What was going on? Why do these big riders decide to skip Dwars?
Well, I think two things. One, it shows how hard Gent Wevelgem was on Sunday. That was a real hard race. And also, I think it just shows you the stakes of how big Flanders is and really how deep and competitive the field is. It's not just the old days of Cancellara versus Bonin. You know, there's 10 guys who can win this race. And they all know it's going to be that 1% difference that really could decide between getting on the podium and winning. Especially in that last hour of racing on Sunday. So I think a lot of guys kind of just erred on the side of being cautious and really wanted to just be as fresh as they can for Sunday's race, because it's going to be a dogfight.
You know, we're going to see Matthew Vanderpoel in that race. And based off of what you saw today and at Gent Wevelgem and some of the comments he made after the race, what do you expect to see from Matthew at Flanders?
That's the big question. Everyone's looking at Wout van Aert and Greg Van Avermaet as being the strongest guys from what we've seen so far going into Sunday. Man, Vanderpoel, you can't count him out. Sometimes that youthful exuberance can carry you a long way. Maybe he doesn't know how hard it's going to be, or doesn't know how, you know, really what to expect. So he's not going to be afraid, and he's just going to go for it. And that actually could help him really in the last part of the race when it really gets crunch time. You know, maybe his team isn't the strongest, but he was even saying he's quite confident in his team because he'll have Stijn de Volder two-time Tour of Flanders champion as his co-captain. And I think that, you know, if he can get into that front group with, you know, over going into the last passages over the Quermont, the Paderberg, I mean, who knows? You know, the guy's got the engine.
Yeah, I was really interested at Gent-Wevelgem to see him throwing some haymakers on, I can't remember which berg it was, real steep, punchy berg, you know, the breakaways off the front, and he was in the main group, and they were trying to reel back the breakaway, and he went, he put in a blistering attack up and over this climb, and, you know, he didn't get a huge gap. He, you know, succeeded in dropping a number of riders, and he had to get back in the field, but, you know, after you see something like that, and knowing that it's the longest race that he's done, you maybe don't think he's going to have much left for the sprint, but for him to finish fourth place, I don't know. To me, that was confirmation that the distance didn't really get to him. I mean, okay, maybe he didn't have that, you know, 0.1% to get over the hump against a guy like Christoph, but I mean, who can do that? But the fact that he was fourth place in the sprint, it's like, yeah, man, the rules almost didn't apply to him.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we'll just see how deep he can go on Sunday. I think the sharp end of the race, when you get the big moves coming down from Van Avermaet and Van Aert and Sagan should be there as well. And then if Quickstep has one or two cards to play, you know, he might have a hard time following that distance because, you know, he's used to racing 1 hour, not seven.
Yeah, and plus the tactics of it come into play, which is, you know, I spoke to a bunch of riders for a piece on VeloNews.com right now about the differences between Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders, and I was asking them which one is tactically more challenging, and everyone was saying Flanders, you know, not just about knowing, you know, where to be on the roads and where the roads are and memorizing these roads, but just when it comes down to that final 50, 60K, there can be pretty big groups of riders that come into the finale together, and sure, everyone is strong, but you have to be pretty smart about where to make your moves, where to gauge your energy, and that's something with Vanderpool, it may take a couple times to learn how to do that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when you talk to these guys, they always say that positioning and knowing the roads is key to Flanders. You just wonder how much he's actually raced down here. I mean, he's Dutchy. He's been racing the cyclocross. You know, how many races has he done down here, even as a junior or U23 on the road? You know, he's done quite a bit of road racing, obviously. So I'm just kind of curious how well he's going to know, you know, where he has to be going into these big Koppenbergs and these big climbs, because that's what everyone says. The real battle is just trying to be in that front part of that bunch going into the Cobbs.
So Vanderpool's victory is obviously a huge story around Dwars. I mean, sure, okay, it wasn't the strongest field ever, but hey, World Tour victory is a World Tour victory. We had another interesting story come out of this race today. With about 75 kilometers to go in the men's race, we looked up to the TV and we saw the motorbikes and an official car drive to the front of the men's race and start to slow things down. And at some point, they even stopped the men's race. And from the overhead shot, it was a bizarre scene where the men's race bunched up on this road. There were some guys riding through like a park and on the sidewalk, and they had to neutralize the race. Apparently, there was a bad crash in the women's race, and at that point in the race, the women's race was using some of the same roads. It had come into close proximity to the men's race, and in order to get ambulances up the road to get to the women in need, they had to neutralize the men's race. And so, you know, the men's race was neutralized, and they started again, and they let the breakaway get up the road, and they did what they always do in racing, which is to try and sort of hit the reset button. But of course, it never really works perfectly, and afterwards we heard some comments from some men's racers about how it changed the dynamics. Yves Lampaert, the defending champion, said, you know, man, I had just expended all this energy to get to the front of the field, and then we get neutralized, and it was right before I was trying to make my move on the Kreuzberg, and then all of a sudden, boom, you know, everyone starts again, he's back in the pack, and you're not able to move up. So, Hoodie, this brings, you just wrote a piece on the site today about how this brings up a larger conversation that the sport has had in the last few months about holding the men's races and the women's races in close proximity, which is something that Flanders Classics, owners of this race, is trying to do. You know, in your reporting, what were some things you came across, some of the different perspectives you came across?
Yeah, I think what they've done here with these races, they've really embraced that concept of, you know, we have the race infrastructure in place, so let's, why not take advantage of that and let the women race alongside the men. I mean, it's worked in other disciplines, and cycling and mountain biking. They have the men's and women's races. And, you know, it really works out well because kind of everyone's here. Everyone's here on the same day. The fans are here. The media's here. And the TV coverage is here. We saw that in these. Ken Velgelum had live TV going out for about 3 hours of the women's race. So there's all these pluses to doing that, obviously. What we saw today, and we saw it earlier this season at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, where sometimes this is like a plate of spaghetti, these roads, right? They're just kind of looping around back and forth. I mean, today the men were coming down the valley at Oudenaarde, ready to bust up into the hills on the other side. The women were coming down from that side, from where the Quermont is coming down. There were two crashes involving women, and they had to get the ambulances around. So the only way they could really do that was kind of stop, close that road down. And it was just bad luck, bad timing today. But it just kind of shows when you are trying to overlap these races, there is that potential where one peloton catches up to the other. Who has the priority? At Nieuwsblad, they stopped the women's race. And today they stopped the men's race. It's a call they have to make on the road. I think there'll be a big discussion within this organization, but also larger in the sport. You know, is this the way, a good model for the sport to go? I think it is, but there's always wrinkles you have to work out.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things where the worst case scenario happens and you have to make a judgment call. And in this scenario, you know, safety is always going to be the most important thing. So it's always going to be most important for them to, you know, attend to these women who need, you know, neutralize the men's race so you can get an ambulance to see these women. Of course, that makes perfect sense. I think, yeah, the judgment call comes into something like Omloop Het Nieuwsblad where, okay, there's this solo woman off the front. The men's field isn't going terribly fast. But, you know, if you're gonna try and neutralize the men's race, you're talking about 70 cars. You're talking about a peloton with, you know, more than 100 riders. You're talking about just an entire race caravan that is substantially bigger than the women's race. And so I know from talking to some of the officials from Flanders Classics, it was a tough decision to make at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, and they knew they'd get blowback, and of course they did. I think today, I don't know if they get blowback. Okay, some of the men's riders were upset and it changed the dynamic of the race, but they made the wise decision. But yeah, to that larger point, it's interesting because I spoke to numerous women's riders about this topic, and I couldn't find one of them who said, I don't think we should be held together. All of them said we like having our races held close to the men's races because of the extra attention, because there's media here. We share the podium with them. I believe it was Trek Segafredo, Ellen Van Dyke, who won the race today, said, you know, we stay in the team hotel with the men. We get to share all of the team infrastructure.
The mechanic stuff.
And at some of these smaller, at some of these Women's World Tour races in Italy that are standalone races, they don't have that. And, you know, look, it's an unfortunate reality within cycling, which is that the women's teams don't have as much funding. The women's races don't get as much attention when they're standalone. So this is really a move by Flanders Classics to get more attention from women's racing. But what we're seeing is that, yeah, the best laid plans of mice and men, you know, sometimes there's things that happen that you can't control.
And it's interesting too, how there's also been a larger, really public push on the Tour de France to try to create a kind of parallel women's tour. We've seen La Tour. You've done a lot of reporting on that, Fred. They've done one day. They've tried to do more stages, you know, a stage ahead of the men's race. They've done the thing in Paris. And no one really seems too happy with that, even though I think the ASO is trying to do the right thing, but they're trying to make it fit into what their larger model is. And I think when you do a one-day race like today, and, you know, in fact, today's race started in a different town, only finished on the same place here in Waregem, and the course kind of looped across each other a couple of times. But really, the dynamic of trying to do that during the Tour de France has officially said they're not even considering having a women's stage race run ahead of the men's race. A lot of people think it would be easy. Say, well, the roads are closed. You've got all the fans there. You know, let's just run the women's race, you know, have it start 100 k's down the road, and they'll finish 2 or 3 hours ahead of the men's. Logistically, that might work. But the Tour de France is saying that's an impossibility, because what it would entail actually is closing the roads even longer than they are closed now, plus security questions, which are a bigger issue, I think, during the Tour. And, of course, the Tour has the publicity caravan and they make lots of money off the Publicity Caravan. So how do you fit in the Publicity Caravan and a women's race all on the same day? So they've said no, but here at the Flanders Classics, they're embracing it, and I think they deserve kudos for that.
Yeah, I think they do too. I think I understand the criticism toward the Tour de ASO about the Tour de France and La Course. I mean, you know, we're praising Flanders Classics because they have a 1-to-1 ratio now between women's races to men's races, and it's not just that, you know, they're holding them in close proximity, but they're saying, you know, hey, let's have a women's Gent-Wevelgem, which they launched, I think it was 8 or 10 years ago. Let's, you know, they've had the women's Tour of Flanders for a while, but like, let's have women's versions of these races. And, you know, with La Course, it's like, what's that? Let's have a 1-day. Or let's have this funky 2-day, even though we have the 3-week men's race. But you're right. It, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these things do come down to money. And, you know, sacrificing Publicity Caravan or asking roads to be open longer when governments and municipalities may not want them to be. It's definitely, you know, I'm not an operations person. But if you sitting across from me, Hoodie, right now, were some capo from ASO, I'd be hitting you with the questions about what would it take to happen? Because, you know, I think we'd all like to see some type of big stage race for women during the Tour de France, or, you know, that could get a lot of attention like the Tour de France. But we don't have it right now. And
well, I think the big problem is you need the sponsor, right?
Yeah.
What comes first, the chicken or the egg? In the sense of, you know, ASO, if they could find a sponsor, they would put up millions of dollars to payroll a women's tour. They'd be all over it. Because, you know, you've seen them expand into new markets, some of these races, the Tour of Yorkshire. Why is there a race on the Tour of Yorkshire? Because there's somebody there willing to pay ASO to run that race. That's how they do it. That's how they make their money. So if someone comes along, wants to sponsor a women's race, ASO will be all over it. I guarantee you that. But, you know, and in fact, I have heard through sources that they've chopped that around. You know, they've chopped around Le Tour. They want to, you know, they're out to make money. So if they can make money off a women's race, they would back it 100%. So I don't think it's an institutional bias at ASO against women's racing at all. And I think that a lot of these bike races that have tried to do things for women's racing, I think, deserve credit because, you know, bike racing doesn't make a lot of money, so they're taking away resources from either other parts of the organization or just money out of their pocket to support women's racing. And, of course, it's not a charity, and it's they have, you know, it has to make money. So it's all part of a longer process. I think there's a conversation moving in the right direction within cycling. You just see more of kind of the old school club opening their eyes to the potential, and that's a good thing in the long term.
So, Hoodie, I spoke to a number of women cyclists after these races. I interviewed Kasia Niewiadoma from the Canyon SRAM team after Gent-Wevelgem a couple days ago. We talked about not just only the race, but some of the dynamics going on in women's racing, including having the women's races close to the men's race, and what this block of racing means to the women's peloton. I also spoke with Ellen Van Dijk today after she won the race. Similar questions, had her talk about her race win, but she also talked about the significance of this block of racing. So we're going to throw to these two interviews real quick. Then we're going to come back and preview what we got going on the rest of the week. Okay, we're walking through Waregem in Belgium right now, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Ellen Van Dijk. Ellen, you just won the women's version of Dwars door Vlaanderen for the second year in a row. I want to talk to you about the race, about this block of racing, about the significance of the cobblestone races for you. First of all, take me through your victory. When did you make your move, and why did you go there?
Yeah, we had a really good plan beforehand with the team. We made it hard on the Côte de Trieux, which is a really hard climb. It's the longest one. And Elisa was really strong, and we were in a group with 11 riders together. And just behind, we also had our other teammates, so it was a good situation. But there were also sprinters, good sprinters in our group. So we knew we had to attack. And yeah, I tried one time already, but I couldn't really, there was not like a full gas attack. And then, yeah, just on top of a hill where everybody was already on the limit, I thought, okay, now it's a hard moment. So now I can try again. And I directly had a gap. So, yeah, then it was just head down and all the way full gas to the finish.
Now, this is the second year we've seen you take a solo win at this race. Why do you think this race is so good for you?
Yeah, I think it's The race is good for me because it's hard, but it's not too many hills. Like, I'm not a super good climber. I can hang on with the climbers, but it's not... in Flanders, for example, there are more hills. I think I should be able to do that too, but... Yeah, I don't know. I just really like this race, apparently. I also wouldn't have thought that I would win today again. But I always feel good in this time of the year. And I focus on these races because this is my my terrain. And today was working out very well.
Now, Ellen, this is the second year in a row we've seen four big races grouped together. We have the Tour of Flanders, Dwars door Vlaanderen, Gent-Wevelgem. And the fourth race is escaping me right now.
Dipana,
that's right. You know, how have this block of racing, how has it changed the dynamic in the women's schedule?
I think it's really good because these races are together with the men's races. So normally we get more attention from media. And this was also broadcasted now. So that's what we really need. And last year, I think there was no live stream. So that's already an improvement. Still, there's much more to improve, but it's getting there, and I really like it. I mean, we have four big races now with the men, same as the men, and after this we have another three Ardennes Classics with the men also.
How is this block of racing different than what we saw 10 years ago during this time of year?
Yeah, I think 10 years ago, I was also racing already, man. then we only had Nieuwsblad and Ronde van Vlaanderen, I think. This for me, it's great. I mean, I love these races, and the more the better, actually. And like in the men's cycling, you really have specialists for classics and like the big tours and everything. And in women's cycling, it's still a bit that a lot of girls are good for the whole year. And I think that in the future we need that too. Like, we need specialists for classics, we need specialists for the big. Big tours, the Grand Tours, and that's a process, and I think that's we're working on that.
Okay, I'm at the finish line at Gent-Wevelgem, running into Kasia Nujadelma. Kasia, we've seen the women's peloton come off some of these early hilly races in Italy with Trofeo Alfredo Binda, Strada Bianca. These we're now in the cobblestone races. How would you describe the attitude and the feel of these races, and how they're different from the Italian races?
Well, I would say that Strade Bianche kind of reminds me of Flanders or Nieuwsblad, those kind of races. Instead of gravel roads, we have cobble roads here. So constantly you just have to fight for your position. I believe that being in a great position is a key to success. Definitely it's the most important thing to always be in the front of cobble section or small hills. Because if you're not there, even if you're the strongest, you can't do anything because the road is blocked and there's no way to pass to go. So atmosphere is amazing, to be honest. Like, I love watching Belgian people they constantly have parties. So they kind of remind me of Polish people who are also like always eager to party and to just have fun.
And this is now, I believe, the eighth edition of this race, Women's Gent-Wevelgem, paired with Tour of Flanders. What's the significance of these races within the Women's World Tour schedule?
I do believe that because of those races, our sport is developing and growing. Those races are well publicized, so definitely we have more attention from media and other people. And definitely it's also nice to just race next to the men's race and, I don't know, share a podium with them, because then more people are interested in our sport. They also know and see that there's something like a woman's cycling.
Tutto bene. Perfect.
All right, well, I think we're going to wrap things up here from this soccer stadium. It's starting to get dark. We got to get on the road, get back to Ghent, find some dinner, maybe find a couple of Trappist beers, put them in our system. We're going to be doing one more podcast before.
We might have to kidnap a few Trappist monks.
Yes, kidnap a few Trappist monks. Take them to our Airbnb.
Take them back to Airbnb.
We're going to do one more podcast at the end of the week to preview the Tour of Flanders, and also preview something that I'm doing, Hoodie, which is myself and Ben Delaney of Royal Massif. We're going to be doing the Tour of Flanders Sportif. which is the amateur ride that they hold the day before the Tour of Flanders. It has, get this, 16,000 participants.
Oh, my.
It's I've done it a few times before. It's a wild and wacky affair. I think I'm going to get Ben on the podcast as well to talk about some of our experiences thus far riding around Flanders. Because the thing about coming over here, like, look, we're over here as journalists. We're doing a lot of work. But, you know, when you come over here as a tourist to check out these races, you got to bring your bike. You brought your bike. You've been doing some of these bergs. What have your rides been like?
Oh, it's been amazing. You know, you're out there riding up the Koppenberg and you just realize how bloody steep these climbs are. And the thing that always amazes me about being able to ride these famous cols or the pave, like here around a football stadium, you know, how often can we go out here and kick the football around on the pitch? Never, right? How often can you go to the Masters and putt around the greens? But, you know, you can never do that. But in cycling, it's like a day before the Super Bowl, you guys are going to be riding the same road, so these guys will be racing on 24 hours later.
Yeah,
and there's not many, if any, sports you can actually do that.
It's super accessible. From Ghent, you ride down this canal to Oudenaarde, and then all the climbs are right there. You go bash around, go back home, have a burger and a beer.
And then pass out.
And then pass out. So that's what we're going to be doing on Saturday. But we're going to come back at you probably Friday or early Saturday with one last pod, previewing the Tour of Flanders. And probably talking a little bit more Matthew Vanderpool. See if he really can do it. We're also going to be hitting some a lot of the team media days between now and then. So we're going to come armed with some perspective, some of the riders of what they're expecting for the Tour of Flanders. So for Andy Hood, I'm Fred Dreyer. We are going to check you guys later. Andy, thanks again.
All right. Thank you.